One woman in one of my Simplicity circles said she just wants to go to a shopping mall with a megaphone and to just yell out to people to say, it's not here.
That is Cecil Andrews, and she's right. Happiness is not in the shopping mall. Never was. I'm Alex Smith, and this is Radio EcoShock. This program is loaded. You'll hear retail expert Howard Davidowitz. He's the shopping expert who says 200,000 American stores will close, and the great days of consumerism are dead. May they rest in peace. Following that interview from New York, we go to France. Michelle Holdsworth is co-author of the new book Globesity, A Planet Out of Control. We explore the relationship between obesity and climate change. Can fat warm the world? In the second half hour, 15 minutes from a new speech by Cecil Andrews, she brought us Slow is Beautiful. Her new book, perfect for tough times, is Less is More. It's all about the simplicity movement and how simple human community saves lives. I'll wrap up the program with a survival project, One Day in Canning, How to Eat Better for Half the Cost. Al Gore has an inconvenient truth. Howard Davidowitz has an ugly truth about our economic crisis. We can call him a veteran of consumer retailing and a prolific guest on the biggest mainstream media. Now he's swimming against the stream of starry-eyed optimism about our so-called recovery. Our guest is chairman of his own well-known advisory company. Thank you for joining us, Mr. Davidowitz.
Thank you for the invitation.
Well, we're told that 500,000 jobs lost last month is a big improvement. Green shoots of recovery are just popping up like the spring. So why am I so worried?
Well, I think you have a lot to be worried about because, of course, we continue to borrow trillions and print money right off the printing press. And the first thing you sit back and you say, starting with what Bush did, throwing checks out of helicopters, the first stimulus plan, all of the stimulus plans, all of the debt we've taken on, which are trillions, that will soon be the size of our whole economy. All of the steps we've taken, we're still losing from 500,000 to 700,000 jobs a month. We're pouring money into the most unproductive parts of the economy. For example, instead of selling 17 million cars and light trucks, we're selling 9.5 million. Yet here we are propping up Chrysler. And at the end of the prop-up, the United Auto Workers' health care plan will still be better than the President of the United States for the average worker at a Chrysler plant. So you really have to question, you know, those five Midwestern states. The fact that, of course, these people supported Obama so tremendously. Also, the outgrowth of this is astounding. There's a bankrupt company in Chicago called Hartmarks. It's a major manufacturer of fine men's suits. And they went bankrupt. A lot of their plants are in the United States. And the union demanded a bailout. They said, bail us out. We're not going to liquidate. We're not going to. And they went to the bank, Wells Fargo. And they said, either you bail us out, they got the treasurer of Chicago behind them, a young guy who wants to run for mayor, or you won't do any more business with the city of Chicago. We demand to be bailed out just like the auto workers. Now, that's what happens when you have car check. That's what happens when you have money being poured into the most unproductive parts of the economy. You waste it all. How can we have three auto companies selling 9.5 million cars and light trucks? It's insane. I mean, we ought to have one. The company would do about $160 billion, probably would have a decent shot at being successful. With three, it's impossible. Only Barack Obama thinks three can be successful. So the point is, when you make political decisions, when you support the unions, when the government is getting into everything, and no one in the government is a businessman, no one in the government knows what they're doing in any respect, they're subject to all sorts of political influences and voter blocks. I don't understand how anything is going to come out of this except exploding the debt, which is, let's go over what's guaranteed. One, we're exploding the debt. That's guaranteed. The second thing that's guaranteed is the debt never goes away, ever. So the debt stays forever. We're borrowing to pay the interest on our debt. So right now, the way the budget is, we spend 4% of the budget for interest on the national debt. That, of course, goes to 8. How can you possibly maintain living standards when that doubles? Just the interest on the debt. I'm not talking about paying down the debt. So everything we're doing appears, to me at least, to border on insanity, totally counterproductive, all based on politics. And the result, we haven't created any more jobs. How can you create jobs putting money into Chrysler? How can you create jobs putting money into an insurance company? We put in $170 billion into AIG, and it is a cadaver, and it will always be a cadaver. When we started doing this, you will recall that Mr. Bernanke said he thinks the taxpayers are going to make money from the Bear Stearns paper they took. You don't hear him talking about that anymore since it's worth 20 cents on a dollar. We've exploded the balance sheet of the United States. The whole, we say everybody's got to deleverage, right? The banks have to deleverage. Consumers have to deleverage. All that is right, by the way. But the government is leveraging up at an unprecedented pace. And by the way, now that the banks have deleveraged and done all of the fake things they were supposed to do, I believe none of them, by the way, their leverage as of yesterday was 25 to 1. 25 to 1 as of yesterday. So that's all of the deleveraging they've done. In addition to that, we're heading into a depression in commercial real estate. That's going to land on the head of the banks. So all of the stress test stuff was one big joke. And as far as the banks getting healthy, because you're converting preferred stock into common, oh, please, this is just a bookkeeping game. No additional money coming into the bank. And, of course, we all know why no additional money's going into the banks, because the Congress won't allocate any more TARP money. The voters hate it. And Mr. Obama's got to bail out the unions in the auto companies. How can he can't do everything. So that's where we stand. Nothing to me, as I look at this, makes any sense. We'll have a little improvement. Soon the government has to stop pumping in money in a year or two because they will be totally bankrupt. The dollar won't be the reserve currency, and then we will effectively be Venezuela. So that eventually the government has to stop printing and giving away money and borrowing money. When all that happens, the economy will go back into a crisis. So things don't look good to me. Living standards will never, ever, 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 ever be the same.
There's no going back. You know retailing as much as anybody alive, I would say. It seems every time I go to our local mall, another store just disappeared with no forwarding address. There's a website for dead and dying shopping malls. Right. Is this temporary, or do you think consumer culture has really changed?
Well, we have to change. And look at the dramatic changes that are taking place. The American consumer senses something is wrong. They spend 10 years spending 6% more than they made. They're now saving at the rate of 4.5%. That's a swing of 10% on 70% of the economy. Pretty significant. I think that's going to go to 10%, and that's what it was when Ronald Reagan ran for president. We had 10% savings after the Jimmy Carter fiasco of a presidency. But the point is that the country was put into a crisis. Could the consumer save? I think the consumer, in spite of green shoots, happy talk, smiles, children, dogs, and everything else going on, I think the American consumer understands there is a huge problem, and they are saving, which is very smart, and they're not spending. When you're losing, we're going to close 200,000 stores this year. We're going to close thousands of shopping centers. Commercial real estate is headed to a depression. Autos are in a depression, of course. Residential real estate is in a depression. Financial services are in a depression. And, of course, commercial real estate will be another shoe to drop right on the head of the banks who passed the stress test. So all of that is going on. it's a very tough situation. We'll close 200, you know, we'll close tons of banks this year. We don't need 8,000 banks anyway. We ought to have probably 5,000 or 6,000. We can't even regulate 8,000 banks. Just like we don't need three auto companies, we can't support them. That's where we're headed. And living standards will never be the same, so we'll be saving more, we'll be spending less. We're going to have to come down to earth, but the only people who aren't doing that are the federal government, who's printing money and spending like crazy and throwing it down the river.
Well, that government strategy to buy up everything to promise the moon. Meanwhile, state and municipal governments are facing massive cuts, if not outright bankruptcy.
Right.
You know, many of my listeners think self-sufficiency and local community organization may be the only way out if governments fail. What do you advise people to do?
I advise people to do what they're doing because I have tremendous faith in the instincts of the American people, and that's why they're saving and spending less. I think their instincts, as usual, are right on. I think you save, you reduce your lifestyle, you're more careful. We're in the biggest trade-down effect in the history of retailing. Starbucks closes 900 stores. McDonald's is winning. Family Dollar is winning. Dollar Tree is winning. Walmart is winning. Every single department store, absolute Saks down 30%. Neiman Marcus down 30%. Sales collapsing. Nordstrom, all of them are bad. Macy's, Penney's, Kohl's, Dillard's, Bon-Ton. Every single department store down, luxury, terrible. We're closing 2,000 jewelry stores. I mean, the business is terrible, so people are buying what they have to buy. They're looking to buy it cheap. That makes a lot of sense to me. It's Aldi time. People are looking for value because they see less possibilities ahead. I think that's exactly what's going to happen. And I think people are responding correctly by saving.
And, you know, it's reported right there in the press every day that the biggest banks are insolvent and you can buy large corporations for a song, yet the stock market goes up 20%. What's going on?
Well, if you go back to the last depression where the stock market lost 90% of its value, the stock market had seven rallies. All of those rallies were up over 20%. And sucked in more investors and ultimately destroyed them. So I can only look back to the record of the last depression and see what happened and look at that for a guidepost. Watch out for dead cat bounces and watch out for bear market rallies because they could be deadly. They will crush you.
And probably crush some pension plans who dove back in, I would say.
I would say so.
Well, many of our listeners are college students. They need decent jobs to pay off these big student loans, and some got suckered into multiple credit cards even though they didn't have an income. Do you think the coming generation is really going to quietly pay off the gigantic debts of banks and deadbeat corporations as well?
I don't know what they're going to do. I think the new generation will be pretty serious about being more conservative, not being as crazy as we are. I think we've just had a terrible record. We put a war in Iraq on a credit card. That would not forget misrepresenting the war, which of course we did, but then putting the whole thing on a credit card and George Bush doubled the debt. He borrowed more than all of the other prior American presidents put together, and Barack Obama is putting him to shame in only a matter of months. So I think that more people will be elected that are more responsible, people who are more realistic. I think we'll have a different generation of leaders, more conservative, more careful, more open-minded. I think the American people are going to demand that. And the burden of debt, you know, debt, the problem with debt is it doesn't go away. So you could inflate the debt. That's one way you can get rid of debt. You can have massive inflation. I think that's where we'll end up. So you could inflate part of this debt away. And my guess is that's what will happen. And that will be the next crisis.
We are talking with expert business advisor Howard Davidowitz. Howard, my last question's a bit of a tough one. You have advised many of the world's top corporations. Did you see this coming, and were you part of the problem?
You know, that's an excellent question. I think, first of all, we're all part of the problem. No one can say they weren't part of the problem. I'm part of the problem. Now, the next question is, did I see it coming? I absolutely did. And that's why we were fortunate to have a superb year in our investment performance last year and own no equities and be short a number of equities. So, yes, did we see it coming? I have to say the truth. Yes, we did. We're having a fabulous year this year in bonds because we covered our shorts in November. So, you know, in that sense, are we managing very well? I would say, yes, we are. But to the question, were we part of the problem? You know, I run a business. We've never had any debt. We've never fired a person. We've never had a year where we didn't give raises. We've never had a year where we didn't give bonuses. We're careful and we're conservative. That's how we run our own business. Those are the principles that we believe in, and that's how we live a life. But I have been advisor to a number of companies who've wanted to do all kinds of things, and, you know, did we help those companies achieve the goals that they set out? That was our job, and that's what we did. So to that extent, have we been part of the problem? I would have to plead guilty to that. When you're in business, your client wants to do X. He's going to choose someone to help him do it. We fought to get those assignments. We did those. We got as many of them as we could. We're in business. We continue to. So everybody's part of the problem. But the issue is going forward, and I've been saying these things that I'm saying now for a decade, if you look back. So the point is that we'll all come to a point where we won't be part of the problem because banks won't have 25-to-1 leverage, which they currently have, and yet they passed the stress test, which, of course, is insane. So we'll straighten ourselves out. I have great confidence in this country and the people in it to find the right way.
Is there anything you'd like to add as we go, a parting message for our listeners?
No, I'd like to wish everybody the absolute best wishes. And at the end of the day, it's all going to work. You can lower your expectation a little bit. We've all had to do that now and again and tough it out. And at the end of the day, we're Americans and we'll be fine.
Mr. Davidowitz, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for the invitation.
As night fell over Los Angeles, I pulled off the freeway to the nearest diner. Like all the freeway restaurants, there was nothing special about this one. It was dim inside as my eyes adjusted to a horrible scene. Settling into my oversized captain's chair, I was the freak. Without a lie, all the other diners, all of them, were over 250 pounds. Towering over me, the big waitress took my order. The arriving plate was wider than my shoulders and laden with three meals in one. I felt so small. As yet another huge couple entered, the man easily 450 pounds, his companion a svelte 300. Later in the parking lot, I understood, perhaps for the first time, the rise of Detroit's personal pickup trucks and SUVs. Two magnificent Walry couples arrived at their four-door pickup truck. The driver was easily 500 pounds, and another huge woman, while they got in together and the vehicle tipped to one side. And when their mates sunk down in the passenger side, the truck righted itself, though lower to the ground. These folks were never going to fit into a Toyota Prius. That's when I realized a connection between diet, the worldwide plunge into fat, and climate change. For one thing, University of Illinois professor Sheldon H. Jacobson calculates it takes a billion more gallons of gas every year just to carry all the extra weight of overweight Americans. That's just the beginning. On May 8th, an article in the British medical journal, The Lancet, calculated overweight and obese people increase greenhouse gases by up to 18%. What with their reliance on motor transport versus walking, and the agricultural gases from producing and shipping all that extra food? It's certainly just not an American tragedy. They call it globesity. A writer for the World Health Organization coined the term in 2001 for a rising epidemic of obesity around the globe, in Denmark, South Africa, China, India, and the Philippines, people are bloated. There are now more overweight people, over a billion, than underfed or starving humans. They are estimated at 800 million. The global industrialized food system is producing a health overload. Fat is becoming a leading killer of humans across the planet. We go to France now to talk with the author of a new book from the publisher EarthScan. Michelle Holdsworth is Associate Professor of Public Health Nutrition at the University of Nottingham, UK. She is one of four authors behind the new EarthScan book, Globesity, A Planet Out of Control. Michelle, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
Well, there's lots to talk about. Some of it's sensitive to people with weight problems, but we must start with the definition of globesity. What is it?
Okay, the term globesity was introduced by the World Health Organization in 2001. It's really a blend of the term global and obesity. And the idea was really to try and expel the myth that obesity was just a problem in westernized countries, and that we now have a worldwide epidemic of obesity.
I noticed chapter one of the book is titled Wave of Panic Across the Planet. Is that over the top, or why should we panic?
Obviously now we're seeing that the incidence of obesity is touching 1 out of 12 people throughout the whole planet, and overweight 1 in 6 people. So it's really an escalating epidemic which has increased over the last 10 years, really, at an enormous rate. In the United States, it obviously increased earlier, but now we're seeing that lots of other countries are catching up with the prevalences that we see in the United States and in North America generally. And we're seeing that these problems are now in even poorer countries of the world.
But it is very advanced in countries like the UK. I've seen unbelievable figures of the number of people who are overweight or obese there.
Yes, in the UK what we're seeing is about 1 in 4 people are obese, which is pretty much the same as in Canada as well, where we also have figures of 1 in 4 obese for men and women. These are still less than in the United States, which has 1 in 3 estimates of people obese. But in terms of overweight, we have roughly 2/3 of the population in England, but also in Canada, who are overweight.
And I guess that's a public health emergency. I mean, a lot of people are going to die much younger because of their weight problems.
Obviously, this is a huge concern that countries, even wealthy countries, can't afford actually to care for the consequences of obesity. Obviously, the particular health concerns are diabetes, which we're even seeing now in children who are overweight and obese. And these are obviously have very high costs in terms of drug treatment. And we're seeing that particularly in the developing countries where I work as well. These countries really are not geared up, are not financially able to support the rise of chronic diseases like obesity is causing, such as cancer, heart disease, and diabetes.
Could you give us a quick example of what you've seen in a developing country on this?
Okay. I mean, I've particularly been working on projects in North Africa, in Morocco and Tunisia and Algeria, and here we're seeing rates of obesity that are not that far off those in the United States for women. And really what we're seeing is that the governments are looking to see how they can adapt the health system to deal with the double burden that they experience of infectious diseases, which are still rampant, and also these chronic diseases. So it's really a huge challenge for them. And they're trying to do their best to prevent the further spread of obesity because of these huge costs.
And that's come up in the last 20 to 30 years because I traveled through all three of those countries in the late 1970s, and people were pretty slim, I have to say.
Right. Yes, I mean, some of those countries do have studies from before which have shown a rapid increase. What's particularly happened is that in a lot of African countries, but also some Asian countries, a lot of people are moving into cities and to, therefore not doing so much physical activity because of city life being much more sedentary, moving less, eating more high-calorie foods which are accessible, which they could previously not eat at all. So the diets are changing, they're doing less physical activity, and this is happening very quickly, which is having a very quick impact on obesity and overweight in adults particularly.
And I think people feel that part of the move up the ladder economically is to start eating meat as well, or more meat.
Yes, obviously that's a definite trend we're seeing, particularly in emerging countries such as China and in Asia, this huge increase in meat consumption, which is obviously of concern because we also see in a lot of countries there's a very strong correlation between meat consumption and obesity. But also obviously in terms of the planet and in terms of the carbon impact of that, that's also a negative effect.
I do want to talk to you about that in just a minute, but you also have the idea in the book that there are parallels between the difficulties in recognizing and dealing with both these problems. What similarities did you see between globesity and global warming as issues?
Well, I think obviously both of them are very complex situations. They both have very complex causes, and also they've both been around for a while, and in terms of public consciousness, people very quickly accept both of them as kind of inevitable situations. But also when we looked more into what the causes of both of these were, they were very related, the actual causes of climate change and obesity are interrelated on quite a lot of different levels.
Well, I suppose one level would be globalization and another industrialization of the food system. This is part of my frustration, Michelle. It's everybody's willing to talk about a healthy diet and exercise for individuals, but it seems like there are corporations who are pushing fattening foods and huge cars and video games where you sit about, but governments don't want to talk about that.
Well, maybe your government doesn't. As you mentioned, the whole food system was originally set up as it is now to produce enough food to feed hungry people. And it was really the goal then of the Food and Agricultural Association to feed hunger and to make sure that nobody was starving. And obviously this has now continued and we're actually overfeeding the population. And within that, obviously the food industry doesn't set out to make people obese, but unfortunately the problem is that the products they sell, which are high calorie, high in fat and high in sugar, are there where there's the most profit to be made. We're particularly looking in Europe as well at how some of their activities could be curbed or controlled. And actually the WHO, the World Health Organization, is looking at trying to work together with industry. Whether this is going to work is another question, but there are moves towards that.
I'd like to see some more responsible advertising, too, because right now I don't have to go very far to find a big billboard here showing a double cheeseburger with double meat patties and two layers of bacon on top of that. So this is going to result in heart disease and diabetes, as you say. Possibly, if we take it on a big scale, millions of deaths. This is a huge chain selling this product. And yet, people aren't reacting to it. I don't see any protests about it.
Well, I think some people are protesting. The International Obesity Task Force, amongst others, has trying to lobby governments to develop a global code for controlling advertising. Now, this is advertising particularly to children in the first instance to see how, whether we can introduce measures which reduce the exposure of children to advertising, because children are seen as the least able to discriminate between advertising and the most easily influenced. So they're lobbying to really try and get governments to take this on board, to introduce controls. Within the European Union, we're looking at introducing controls on advertising to children during the evening television, for example. There's a big debate on whether that should be up to the age of 18 and what time of day that should be. So there are initiatives, but these need to be, governments need to support them and to try and resist the lobbying from industry that they obviously get.
Well, that's good to hear. Our guest is Michelle Holdsworth, part of a team of authors of a new book, Globesity, A Planet Out of Control. Now, Michelle, I want to get into the climate change a little bit more, but first I want to just check this one thing. I've looked at some blog reactions to the concept of Globesity, and some overweight people, they're outraged. They'll now be blamed for global warming as well. How do you handle that kind of sensitivity in the book?
Well, Globesity doesn't actually blame. It isn't actually a term which is connecting the global climate change with obesity. And I think for myself, I would rather focus on the fact that the causes of obesity and the causes of climate change are actually joint, if you like, or shared. And it's not the fact that when someone has become obese, it's obviously there's been a lot of press recently about the fact that being obese has a larger carbon footprint. But for me, we need to go one step back and look at what causes obesity. And for us, that's really looking more at the food system. I mean, our basic belief is that people who are obese, they're more really, if you like, it's absurd to blame the overeaters themselves. They're really just a product of a very unhealthy food system, which is pushing cheap food at them and making unhealthy food inaccessible.
I really agree with you on that, you know, but two researchers, Phil Edwards and Ian Roberts, published a letter in the UK medical journal The Lancet on May 8th. They said the trend towards obesity adds directly to climate change, citing greenhouse gases from all that extra food production, the need for bigger vehicles instead of walking and so on, you know. Wouldn't you have to agree there is a direct connection too?
Yes. No, I do agree that there is a consequence of being obese on the carbon footprint. As you just said, you just quoted a study which has been covered quite a lot in the press in Europe as well. But I don't think we should blame the obese, because what I'm saying is that the reason that so many are becoming overweight and obese is precisely for all these reasons which are related to factors outside of their control, to the environment that they're living, which we're all responsible for, which push extra portions of food onto people, which make eating healthily very difficult, but also make doing physical activity very difficult as well. So we would argue that it's actually the obesogenic environment that we live in which is contributing mostly to obesity. And if we could do something about that, then yes, we would be able to deal then with this consequence of being obese and its impact on the carbon footprint.
It is a really difficult problem. I know, for example, in Latin America, some places, people don't have access to vegetables, even though it's a great place to grow them, because of the way land ownership is laid out. They just can't get access to the land to grow it. So it seems like there are large social changes that would have to happen to combat Globesity.
Yes, indeed. I mean, it really, some European academics have suggested very radical changes are needed to combat obesity worldwide, because as we can see, it's escalating throughout the world, and that something really very fundamental needs to happen to change it. We can't expect people to change their individual behavior unless we can change the environment in which they're living. Individuals are programmed really to prefer sweet and fatty foods, which was in times of famine an advantage for them. That's why we all enjoy these kind of foods. That's why our bodies crave them. And so we're asking people to go against a lot of their sensorial instincts, but also we need to give them an environment which helps them control their weight, whereas the environment, as you just mentioned yourself, you go out into the street and you see lots of incentives to eat unhealthily, they're all conspiring against that. So really, we think we need fundamental changes. Some people have suggested in the UK to introduce rationing of food is what's needed to help both with the climate consequences of overeating and obesity. Obviously a very radical solution.
Yeah, so you would have a ration ticket for so many calories and that's it. Well, that is going to be hard to talk people into that one, but we'll see.
Yeah.
how bad things get before we look for big solutions. Well, your book concludes by calling obesity and climate change an odd couple. How do you see these two issues interacting in the next decade or so?
Well, that's a difficult question. In terms of interacting in the next decade or so, I think if people's awareness about carbon emissions can have an influence on their actual weight behavior, that could be one way. But I still think we need to make very fundamental changes to the environment that people live in and the way that we live. For example, the use of cars has been shown to have a huge impact, obviously on carbon emissions, but also on people's weight gain. That using your car every year for an hour every day, you're likely to actually gain about 14 kilograms over a two-year period. So that's two stones. So just a small thing like using your car can actually promote your weight gain as well.
Is there anything you'd like to add, a message you'd like to leave with our listeners?
I think one of the things I'd really like people to understand is to really understand that it's a myth that obese people become obese because they're greedy and lazy. So much research has shown that people become overweight and obese over a very long period of time and with very small differences in their energy balance. So they just may be eating a little bit more than they need or walking a bit less than they need every day, and suddenly in 5 years they find they've become overweight or obese. So I really think it's important that people understand that stigma associated with overweight and obesity is untrue, and we need to understand the real causes to find the real solutions.
Thank you so much. We've been talking with Michelle Holdsworth, co-author of a new book from EarthScan called Globesity, A Planet Out of Control. Michelle, thank you again for sharing your time.
Okay. Thank you very much for speaking with me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Download this interview as a free MP3 from our website at ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. As promised, we're going to look at real alternatives to mall life and Globesity. One of our most downloaded speeches has been Slow is Beautiful with Washington State's Cecil Andrews. It isn't just the slow food movement, but living slower and enjoying it more. Now Andrews has a new book that is perfect for the present times, Less is More, Embracing Simplicity. Her speech in Vancouver, May 11, 2009, was just titled Simplicity. It's a look at not just surviving, but thriving with much less. Here is 15 minutes from Cecil Andrews.
It's always been something I've been fascinated about, simplicity. And I think of simplicity as the examined life. It's asking yourself what's important and what matters. And it's trying to figure out what's essential in your life and then getting rid of the inessential. But it sometimes is hard to talk about simplicity because people are afraid of it. And the story I always like to tell is about this young man who came up to me once and said to me, aren't you the person who talks about that self-deprivation movement? And I think, what? This is what people think, that this is about self-deprivation? And so those of us involved in the simplicity movement have worked really hard to try to get people to see that it's not just about cutting back, it's about cutting back and enjoying your life more. That if you're not enjoying your life more, you're not doing it right. And so we worked on this for years, and then not long ago, I had a young man come to our house, and he was walking around looking at things, and he was looking at the stuff on the refrigerator, and I had just started my grocery list, and he was looking at my grocery list, and he said, whoa, he said, you really walk your talk. And I said, what? And I came over, and I looked at the grocery list, and on it, it said, bread and water. And I said, no, this is expensive organic bread and this is water for a party. But I thought, you know, how do you get people to understand what this is? Because people really are afraid of it. And so we worked really hard, but what I want to give an example of why this is so particularly important now, not just because of the economy, and it's something I start out my Slow is Beautiful book with. And it's about, we were down in Palo Alto, and we had just pulled up in front of the Whole Foods. We were parking, and across the street from us, an older woman was trying to park. She was trying to parallel park, but But this younger woman in an SUV had pulled up right behind her and wouldn't let her park. She just kept laying on the horn and just beeping over and over and over. Finally, she gave her a little space, and the older woman slid back into the parking place. But then the younger woman pulled up next to her and rolled her window down and started yelling at her. And we were watching this, and then all of a sudden we saw the younger woman reach over to get something off of her seat. And we thought, oh my God, is there going to be a shooting here? Well, she picked up something and threw it out the window and sped off. And then the older woman got out of the car, and we got out and said we got the license number. And we said, well, what did she throw at you? And she said she threw a handful of rocks. Well, that seemed even more bizarre, didn't it? So I began to see this incident as so symbolic of life now in the United States. When you take each little part of it, first this incredible impatience that you have to get somewhere, and imagine getting that angry because somebody slows you down. And then the fact that she was just, it was so hostile, that what's happened in the States, of course, is not only of a pace of life just shot up, but people are more and more hostile to each other, more and more angry. And then, of course, with the SUV. The SUV was the symbol of what we're doing to the planet in the name of status, of wanting to have a status symbol. And then, of course, there we were in Palo Alto, which is supposed to stand for success itself, not far from Stanford University. And I'm sure Stanford had a lot of those CEOs we've been seeing on television graduate from their business school. So it's kind of like this was encapsulated of what's going on here in this country. And so in thinking about simplicity, I think that's interesting to see if you can get people to look at what simplicity is about. And as you said, my forthcoming book for New Society Publishers is Less is More. And then it's Embracing Simplicity for a Healthy Planet, a Caring Economy, and Lasting Happiness. But this whole idea that we need to show people actually what simplicity really is, because simplicity, interest in simplicity has waxed and waned. And obviously right now people are more interested in it. And what we have to see this as a teachable moment, because simplicity is much more than people just saving money. Much more than people cutting back. Essentially, our basic goal in the simplicity movement is to get people to look at their belief system about money and to see what it's done of what people believe. And it's interesting because obviously this is a critique of the consumer society. And one woman in one of my simplicity circles said she just wants to go to a shopping mall with a megaphone and to just yell out to people to say, it's not here. Don't you think that would be a good idea? Just to start, we have to use this to get people to think about this. It's interesting because over the years, and those of you involved in the simplicity movement know this, people will say to you, but what if you get everybody to spend less? Won't it ruin the economy? Well, it wasn't us simple, poor, simple livers who ruined the economy. And so now we can say, who was it that ruined the economy? It was the greedy, rich people who have ruined the economy. And of course, we've always had an answer that we like to give is, as some of you know, John DeGraff, you know, what is the economy for? Is the economy to make a few people very rich, or is it for the well-being of people and the planet? So, and in fact, John DeGraff has a new documentary coming out called What's the Economy For? So a lot of people are trying to figure out what simplicity is, and we're trying to figure out how we can talk to people about it. What with our difficulty of getting over this feeling of people thinking it's something unpleasant, that what we discovered was the slow food movement. And everybody knows about the slow food movement now. And when you see a movement that is this successful, a movement that spread almost spontaneously around the world, you have to ask, why is it so successful? And you have to look and see what it's doing. And so we began to think, of course, you know, here is the whole idea of people not only just taking time to eat, but they're eating with friends and having wine and conversation. It's really the image of the joyful community. And the way they took this to say it's not just about food, but it has to do with, you know, your effect on the planet, has to do with social justice, you know, what are the corporations doing? So it's just, this beautiful way of looking at a social movement. And so then we started thinking, well, you can look at slow through every kind of lens. It's like, what would a slow family be like? You know, a slow family, they're having their meals together. And what would slow education look like? You know, wouldn't it be great to just be able to say that you're a slow learner and not have that be something negative? And then I know one man said that he was a slow husband, which I wondered what that was as well. But it's interesting to start looking and to start thinking, how do we talk to people about these issues, about asking people what's important and what matters? And it's interesting because if you think about simplicity and you think about the whole idea, a lot of people have said about, for those of us in the simplicity movement, that all we are is a bunch of middle class whiners. That, you know, other people, you have what you want and you don't want anybody else to get anything. And so they say it has no relevance to poor people. But it's interesting because, you know, of course, poor people are not living simply. To live simply is to make a choice. And they need more money to be able to make a choice, more money to be able to live simply. But simplicity will help poor people. There's a real social justice part to this, because obviously the reason people have to stay in poverty is because some others want more than they should have. So you can link all this, but to take and look at simplicity through the slow life movement, it relates to the first one when you talking about happiness, that it's really asking people is what makes you happy. And this is so strange, because all the research shows that after a certain point, more money does not make people happier. And it's like this is something I want you to try to work into your conversation whenever you can. This is so deep in United States culture that if you're rich, you will be happy. It's believed so deeply. And even though people might know all the literature about winning a lottery, and that they know that in the first week you're ecstatically happy, but by the end of the year, you're not only not any happier, you're probably less happy than you were before, but still, all of us, even if we don't buy a lottery ticket, we think, but if we won the lottery, we would be an exception. You know, we would be happier. That at this really root level that we all believe this in the States, and of how to work with that, because, as we said, what does make people happy? Social ties make people happy. The research is so clear. But again, I'm going to ask later, this is not something that I grew up realizing. I mean, you'd think that we would know this. It's like, why does this have to come out of research? But basically, I knew you needed meaning in your life, but I basically grew up thinking I had to be an achiever. I needed to work really hard, and that was the key to happiness. But what it comes out, it's people's social ties, it's the amount of time you spent with other people, it's this sense of the joyful community. And so when you start thinking about that and look at some of the statistics, and this one is a very shocking one, that if you are not in a group this year, right now, and you joined a group, your chance of dying within this next year would be cut in half. Isn't that incredible? Now, maybe your chance of dying isn't very big anyway, but the point is it has a tremendous effect. They have found that middle-aged women with large social circles have 23% lower rate of coronary disease, and that if you... most research shows that people who are isolated suffer 2 to 4 times the chance of getting sick in some way. That talking to your neighbor has this incredible effect on your health and well-being and everyone's around you.
That was Cecil Andrews speaking in Canada on May 11th and recorded by Josh Reimer of VIP Video in Vancouver. Usually I get these speeches up on our website for your quick download, but Hold on, my friend. Not so fast this time. Slow is beautiful. We'll try and get more new Cecil Andrews on the coming Radio EcoShock shows. Meanwhile, we have some important rhubarb on the stove.
And now for something completely different.
Hi, this is Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock. Our next topic seems like a steep change, but it isn't. I'll outline how I canned 9 bottles of rhubarb last weekend. You'll learn how to get started. Ensuring food for the family helps me cope with frightening financial news, and I'm switching to a lower carbon food supply. It's cheaper, too. That's all part of my bigger claim. We need to put away food at harvest time. No one living in all the centuries past could believe we even need to say this. Of course we harvest nature's bounty when it comes. But big city folk forget this basic survival trait within 1 or 2 generations. We depend on massive food webs from oil-based industrial agriculture transported by fossil fuels. Fresh vegetables and fruits arrive improbably in winter, loaded with chemicals. Meanwhile, droughts, floods, new pests, and fungi threaten food production, not to mention the 100 million new people we have to feed every year, as the global financial and trading system seems to be collapsing. Maybe you should learn along with me how to put food away. Rhubarb is an easy way to start. These tart red stalks are among the first spring crops. They arrive about the same time as cheap bottles and canning equipment pop up in hardware stores and Walmart shelves. And when you see the bulk stacks of bottles, that is the time to buy. Canning equipment is a little like fashion clothing. The summer equipment arrives in spring, and later in the season it's all gone, replaced by some other stock. I'm committed to learning the canning cycle, so I have more than a dozen cases of 12 1-liter or 1-quart bottles already stored away. Don't make the mistake I did in choosing a cheap enamel canner. These are the dark, sometimes spotted enamel canning kettles that come with a lid and wire bottle rack, usually for less than $40. They are very good for canning acidic fruit. Last year, fearing the worst, I bought one for $23 in my favorite hardware store. Last weekend, when I went to use it, useless. First of all, this canner could not sit flat on a burner on my small electric stove. It was so wide, it either hit one of the stove rims, lifting it off the burner, or tipped slightly, even on the biggest element. That means uneven heat or even a dangerous situation. Worse, this alleged 5-quart canning kettle was not deep enough to allow a 1-liter or a 1-quart bottle to boil vigorously. The kettle is only 10 inches deep, and you need at least 12 inches deep, preferably 14, to prevent boiling water from splashing all over the stove. Measure the canner depth before you buy. I still managed to use this canner, though, as a pot to heat up the rhubarb. You'll need 2 or 3 big pots anyway. My project was to get fresh-cut rhubarb, preferably organic, and can it the very same day to preserve all the vitamins and taste. That turns out to be an all-day, maybe even into the evening deal. I started with a visit to the first farmer's market to open this year in the middle of May. The market opens at 8 a.m., and you have to be there well before 10 to get any decent produce. I bought organic rhubarb at $2 a pound Canadian at 2 different stalls, cleaning one of them right out. That's half the price for non-organic rhubarb at Safeway, where it was $3.99 a pound. Already, I'm set to cut my food costs in half. And later in the winter, rhubarb will show up at a Safeway from God knows where at $5.99 a pound, 3 times the price I paid. Plus, my food was grown locally from a family operation with much lower carbon costs for transportation. Rhubarb is a good introduction to canning because it has entry-level requirements. The fruit is so acidic that it requires much less processing. No need for a pressure canner. The cheap enamel kind works. Since you will be adding sugar, the result keeps well in a fridge for well over a week, maybe 2, even when you do open it much later. It will be cooked, ready to eat in any emergency, or acting as a quick add-on for cereal when you are busy. This is a food that will not crowd out your freezer and doesn't depend on electricity to keep well. Wash the rhubarb, cut it into 1-inch pieces. I bought $43 worth, a substantial investment for me. That was 21 pounds of raw rhubarb. It produced 9.5 liters or maybe 9 quarts of preserves ready for the winter. If you add in the cost of the bottles and a little for your canner, that's maybe $6 for a liter or a quart. Not bad, as each bottle will provide topping for cereal or yogurt for three people for well over a week. Rhubarb is also good for your digestion, as people in the Middle Ages knew well. When doing a large batch, you have to plan your stove use carefully. First of all, you need clean hot bottles and lids. I don't put my bottles in a dishwasher, even though my fancy Maytag has a sanitize option. In my experience, dishwashers wear away at teacups. The machine may scratch the all-important rim area of the bottle or chip it, making the bottle dangerous to use. Hand wash it in soapy water, rinse, and then heat the bottles in a big pot of hot water. If you feel the need to sanitize them, bring them to a boil for 5 minutes, but that isn't necessary when processing acidic fruit like rhubarb, peaches, or most berries. The bottle will be sanitized in the cooking phase anyway. Once the rhubarb is chopped up, don't cook it yet. You add sugar, a little less than 1/2 cup to 4 cups of rhubarb. That means you toss your cut rhubarb into a measuring cup as you go, and then pour that into your big cooking pot. Keep track, so you know how much sugar to add. I use brown sugar. Mix the sugar and fruit together and let stand for 4 hours. Lots of water will come out of the fruit, making a syrup to accompany your bottling process. The secret now is to have everything hot as it goes in to the hot but not boiling water in your canner. These bottles should be hot in a pot of water. I heat up my lids and rings in a separate little pot because you shouldn't boil the rubber on the lids. And my rhubarb is hot, in this case in 2 big pots, since it wouldn't fit in my undersized enamel canner and still leave room to stir in that sugar. So I put another batch of rhubarb in a big kitchen pot. That makes 4 pots on a 4-burner stove with no room to spare. The hot fruit goes into hot jars using a canning funnel with a quick wipe of the rim by a clean cloth or paper towel, add the lid, screw on the outer ring, and place it in the canning kettle so it doesn't touch the other jars. In my case, I used a cheap enamel kettle to heat the fruit, bringing the sugary mixture to a boil for just 1 minute only, then turn down the heat. It will actually cook in the jars during the canning process. Load up your jars and bring to a boil for 15 minutes near sea level, or maybe 18 minutes for the high-altitude folks. I also own a big American Classic pressure canner, the 7-quart model. I bought it last winter by scrimping and saving, foreseeing the need to be able to can anything, including vegetables or even meat for others in the family, which, unlike acidic fruits, need a pressure canner for sure. At $330, it was an expensive survival tool, but it should last a lifetime, as this design has no rubber seals to wear out. It's highly recommended. I used the deep pressure canner for the rhubarb, but just left the lid unclamped because all I need is a boiling water bath for the jars. Note the pressure canner is plenty deep to allow a rolling boil, and it curves up from the stove at the edges, meaning it gets proper even heat on any stove. My model is advertised as a 7-quart canner, but for the life of me, I can't see how it could hold more than 6 bottles at a time. Maybe there's a taller, thinner bottle out there. I used wide mouth bottles for the rhubarb. It took 2 rounds of canning to get 9 full bottles. I was done by 8:30 that night. Don't forget, 4 hours of that day was just sitting around a while the sugar worked into the fruit. It takes all night for the bottles to cool, and this is when the seal is really made. Put your hot bottles where they can sit undisturbed and totally untouched, even by you, for 12 hours. Then check that the lids have pulled down concave, which indicates a tight seal. I won't go into safety procedures now. You can check that on the net. The bottles need to be stored in the dark. Most people just put them back in the cardboard box they came in and then in a cool, dark place, whatever you have available. This rhubarb will still be great to eat 10 months from now and may keep up to 2 or 3 years with some decline in taste. The idea is to eat it every year and replace it with fresh stock when that comes in. That was my trial run before I go to the farms to buy a few bushels of fresh fruit and vegetables this summer. In fact, I look at this whole year as a trial run for learning basic survival tactics. It looks like our so-called normal economy will continue, for the employed at least, for another year, maybe. After that, the wheels may come off. Then smart adapters will be using homesteading tools like canning wherever we live, just to ensure food for the coming year. But even if a miracle saves the banks and the shipping and the shopping malls, you and I can still get fresher, better food at half the cost or less by buying in bulk as each crop arrives. Happy Food Storage helps me relax in scary times. I hope it helps you too. I'm Alex, and this is Radio EcoShock. Download this free MP3 anytime from our survival page at ecoshock.org. Join us next week as we learn about food storage for the faint of heart from edible landscape expert Robin Wheeler. Thanks for listening. No doubt, we'll survive this mess together.